Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. I'd like to thank our sponsor today, Salumi Artisan Cured Meats. Well, today we're looking forward to the many fun and food-centric festivals that happen during our fall season, and I've invited three special guests to be on our show today to share some of their perspectives and some of their experiences with these fun things to do in the fall. We're going to have Ileana de la Vega, chef and teacher at the New Culinary Institute of America's Latin Cuisines program in San Antonio, to talk to us about Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, celebratory foods and traditions and things to think about when you're celebrating this very, very special holiday in a lot of the different Americas. Then we're going to get some advice from author, cook, and gardener Lucinda Hudson on creating your own Day of the Dead party and hear about her latest trip to Mexico, where she's been researching her new book coming up. And finally, we'll talk to a locavore and former chef Elizabeth Winslow, who's going to share her perspectives on how to make all of your festivals and parties local and seasonal. So we're going to take a quick break and then be back with our first guest, Ileana de la Vega. Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. And the show today is brought to you by Salumi Artisan Cured Meats. Thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to the show, Ileana.
Hi, Marla. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm really happy that you can take some time out of your incredibly busy schedule this week to talk to us.
No, thank you. Thank you for hosting me.
Sure. I'm going to tell our listeners just a little bit about you. Ileana is a Mexican specialist at the Culinary Institute of America. That's the new campus for the CIA in San Antonio. And she's a member of the CIA's Latin Cuisines Advisory Council and also a consultant in Mexican cooking. Before she joined the CIA a couple of years ago, well, actually it was in 2007, Ileana was acclaimed for her reinterpretation of Oaxacan moles at her restaurant El Naranjo in Oaxaca. She was born and raised in Mexico City, and she's been featured in top U.S. publications, including the New York Times, Bon Appetit, and Condé Nast Traveler. So, Ileana, why don't you just tell us a couple of things about what you're doing this week? There's a very exciting conference happening at the CIA campus in San Antonio.
That's right. Thank you. Well, we're hosting here the Latin Flavors American Kitchens, which is a conference where, you know, it is invitation only, and it's our second annual symposium on Latin cuisines, culture, and exchange, where we brought, chefs from Latin America. And this year, we're featuring Brazil, Veracruz in Mexico, Puerto Rico, and Chile. And, we bring them to show, you know, what is the food in those countries. Or those places exactly, and we try to get a little bit of as many people that we can bring down to show what is the food in the countries. You know, what is the real food from really top chefs to just a humble person that makes the best whatever tortilla or something like that. So that's so we're hosting this conference to try to impact a little bit, try to show how it is the food in the countries and bring it down here from the experts.
Well, and who are some of the experts who will be here this week?
We are bringing, for example, from Veracruz, we're bringing Tomás Dominguez, who is a chef in Guatepec, Veracruz. We're bringing Johannes Prieto, which is another chef from, Boca del Rio in Veracruz also. And, a Totonac woman from the north of Veracruz, that she is, you know, she's a humble person, you know, very indigenous person, and she really makes, you know, wonderful food from the area, you know, a little bit unknown food and such. So you're then from Brazil, is Mara Sales, and it's also coming Rodrigo Oliveira and Teresa Corsao. From Puerto Rico, Willow Bennett, and Adolfo, oh my God, what is the last name? Okay, sorry about that.
And that's okay.
Too many names, right? And also, you know, from the United States, we are having Alfredo Ayala, I'm sorry, from Puerto Rico, I'm so sorry. And then from the United States, we're bringing Mark Miller, for example. Norma Manakin is also coming.
And is he in Santa Fe right now?
Pardon me?
Is he from Santa Fe?
Mark Miller, he's actually from California, if I'm not wrong.
California, okay.
Yeah, but he, you know, he makes, you know, he has Coyote Cafe in New Mexico. For
right, that's why I'm thinking that.
That's
okay.
Right. And Robert Del Grande from Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. So a lot of, you know, big personalities that we brought to this conference.
And Martha Prothia?
That's right. Also, she's coming.
And, you know, I just heard that she's cooking at the White House tomorrow.
That's right, tomorrow. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. So she'll be in Washington cooking at the White House for the president and the family, and then the next day she'll be here in San Antonio to talk about
cacao and other things. That's
exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes.
Sounds really, really like a wonderful conference. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
So what I really wanted to talk to you about today, or what I was hoping you can share with our listeners, is sort of a cultural and historical look at what Dia de los Muertos really is about. And maybe you could start with just contrasting it with our Halloween celebration and what is different about Day of the Dead. And then I'd like to ask you about the food that will be customary to make for that.
Yes. Okay, well, it's certainly quite different. I will, you know, in a way I will compare it more like to Europe, what it was, you know, at the beginning. Because, you know, everything changed when the Spaniards arrived to Mexico. You know, before them, the celebration was, you know, not only in one specific time of the year. It was all, you know, all over the year, they had different celebrations dedicated to the dead, either, you know, the children that were dead or the older people. Then when the Spanish arrived, they brought, you know, all the Catholicism and the beliefs and, you know, the All Souls Day and things like that. So it changed a little bit and just is focused now at the end of, you know, October, beginning of November. So it is just the concept of both things is very different, because what it is celebrated in Europe is the fact that on both sides of the ocean, it is a day dedicated to the memory of the deceased loved ones. For Europeans, that is almost a taboo. Nobody talks about that, you know, and everybody says it seems like something sad. Well, in Mexico, we grew up with the notion of the dead, the people dying, the cemetery. It is not like the kids don't go to cemeteries. We go since we are kids. And it's kind of, it's a familiar thing. It's nothing that to be ashamed or not talk about or something. And we even make fun of it. We use funny expressions to say, like, colgó los tenis, which means that the deceased person hang up the tennis shoes, or he stretch his leg, or he left with a skinny one, or, you know, kind of things like that to refer to one person's when he's dead. We make fun of it. We make really, you know, beautiful art crafts and drawings, and, you know, there is a lot of art related to the dead, because we think it's nothing bad. It just happens, and it's natural. So even, you know, to celebrate the kids when they're dead, it is also, you know, that is the day we choose the day of the November the 1st for the kids, and November the 2nd for the grown-ups and all the dead people.
So is that's traditional to have the 2-day celebration? I didn't realize that the first day is for the children and the second day is for the adults.
Yeah, and the night that it starts is, you know, the October the 31st, and then it goes, you know, as indigenous is the community and isolated, you will find more roots. You know, it's more deeper than, you know, the celebrations that they are. Most of, you know, in Mexico, almost everywhere where it's indigenous population, you will find something. Where it's more famous, not that doesn't exist in other places, is, for example, in Oaxaca. In almost every community in Oaxaca, a big celebration on the cemetery happens, and, you know, starting from the October the 31st. And then, for example, in also in the state of Mexico, in a place called Mixquic, it's another really huge celebration. And probably the most famous abroad is the one in Pátzcuaro, Michoacán, because this is a kind of island, and it's surrounded by water. So the celebration is just, you know, kind of magical just for the environment. Then also in Puebla, in San Juan Chilac, which is a little community very close to Oaxaca, you know, to the borders of the state of Oaxaca, there is also a huge celebration, as well in Papantla, Veracruz, or in Chiapas, or many other places. Now, if we go to urban areas, either, you know, Oaxaca City or Mexico City or things like that, the altar, you know, the shrine, it is more into the crafts. You know, there are more elaborated crafts in some of the indigenous places. It can be just a few candles and flowers and probably some food. You know, very simple things, but very, you know, it comes really from the soul of the people. In other places, it's more elaborate, always bread and tamales and few more things. So they're always into that. So now if you want to talk about produce, you let me know.
Well, yes, and what I was going to just clarify with that, it was in the more indigenous and the more rural areas, did the celebrations happen more at the cemeteries, more out in public, and then perhaps in the more urban areas, people take it more inside their homes with their own personal altars and celebrate that way, or are there big celebrations in the urban areas as well?
You know, in recent years, it is more celebrated also, you know, in both places, even in, you know, in the city, and it is open, but it's hard to explain this, because, you know, for example, when I was a kid and I was growing up in Mexico City, you know, even my family's from Oaxaca, my mother used to put always the shrine. And, you know, friends of mine, when we were kids, they were asking me, you know, is your mother a witch or what? She has those things. Because it was not common in Mexico City at the time that the people do those things. Now, if you went to Oaxaca at the time, everybody was making, you know, one shrine for the dead. And now Mexico City is everywhere. Everybody puts, you know, the altar, or many people, you know, kind of celebrating, kind of, it's a, how do you say, like a re-encounter with the past of our culture, that it was not that open some years ago.
Well, and tell us something about the kinds of foods. I know that in Mexico, we work very much with the seasonal foods that are locally available, and they've become icons of the kinds of ingredients that go into some of these feasts and the celebratory foods. But can you tell us something, a little bit about the kinds of ingredients and the kinds of foods and flowers that are used?
Of course. Yeah, you know, for example, produce, we have like sugar cane. Normally you will find it always. Mandarins, guavas, limas, which is not exactly a lemon nor a lime. You know, it's another citrus fruit. A type of crab apples, loquats, jicamas, bananas, oranges are pretty common. Sometimes they put, you know, also peanuts. It's very common to find peanuts. And most of them are seasonal fruits for this time, as well as, you know, flowers like marigold flowers. Or nube, which is a white flower, very tiny. I couldn't find the botanical name of that. Then the coxcomb is also common to find it. Now, on food, for example, celebratory food is always mole and always tamales. Then bread, specialty bread baked just for this occasion, sometimes with a kind of a human figure, or sometimes it resembles like a skull. You know, you will find like little bones. Well, we call it bones, but it's, you know, obviously it's a piece of bread, you know, kind of in the shape of a bone, a human bone. And the little ball on the top, it is the skull. It means a skull on top. And so there are different figures in the breads, depending on the area, the type of bread you get. Also, you know, sometimes they are seasoned with, you know, flavored with aniseed, sometimes with orange blossoms. And so they can be different, each one from the other. And then always there will be the food that the deceased person, which is dedicated the shrine to, it was the, you know, the favorite food. So if he loved, I don't know, albondigas, for example, meatballs, well, there will be a you know, a little plate with meatballs. If he loved to drink a mezcal, there will be a mezcal. If he likes to drink Coke, there will be Coke. If he smoked, and his favorite brand of cigarettes will be displayed. So that's kind of the things that you will find also in the shrine.
Well, and to talk a little bit about the moles and tamales, we're very fortunate, if you live in the Austin area, to have Ileana will be giving a cooking demonstration at the Mexicarte Museum during their 25th year of celebrating Day of the Dead here in Austin. And it will be actually on Saturday, October 24th. But it's an all-day festival that culminates in a big parade. And Ileana is going to be giving a cooking demonstration of mole and tamales from the Puebla tradition, actually. But Ileana, if you could just give us a flavor, give us a little taste of what goes into making mole.
Well, a lot of labor and a lot of love, really. That's number one thing that you prepare. When you prepare mole, that's the first thing you need. For the mole poblano, we use certain kinds of chiles, like anchos and, some others. It is a lot of peanuts and sesame seeds, and some tomatoes, and tomatillos, onion, some seasonings like cinnamon, and, it is a lot of work to do it, but it's really worth it. And essentially, the mole is the celebratory food for all over Mexico. So we use it for baptism. We use it for weddings. Special occasions, and the Day of the Dead, of course, is a special occasion, definitely. So that is, really, really important for Mexicans, to eat a mole. And so we offer that, all the work and all the love that we put into making this dish, it will be offered to the dead, because they will be coming from a long journey from the, wherever they live now, come back to the earth and see us and stay with us for a day. That's the time there, that the time window frame that they have available to come back and see us. So we prepare that kind of food. We offer them our work and our labor. And also tamales is a traditional thing since the pre-Hispanic time. Tamales had been, for many years. There was even a celebratory feast in the ancient times, in the pre-Hispanic times, that they were making tamales for the dead. So it is just, putting both things together, offering the best and the more labor and love for them.
And how much time should you set aside to make an authentic mole?
Wow.
Just to give people an idea, this is a very much a dish made with love.
Right. But, what it is important is it depends. When you make it mole, you don't make mole for four people. It's so much work for just four people. So you make mole for feeding a crowd. Mm-hmm. So then it's worth it. All the effort and all the time that it takes, it will be, worth it for something. So, let's say like we're making mole for 20 people or 25 people, total time from starting, it will take from scratch completely, it will take probably, 5 hours at least or more. It depends on the type of mole. We're making mole poblano, and, probably a little bit, over 5 hours will take that to be done from scratch to the eating time, let's put it that way. So
right. And so this is definitely something that you might want to do with friends and family and make a day of it and have a really fun time doing it.
Exactly.
And I'm going to be posting on the Edible Austin website. We'll put a copy of Ileana's mole recipe, mole poblano recipe and tamales, on our website. I think we're going to wait probably a few days to do that, but check back at edibleaustin.com, and we'll put her recipes up there for everybody listening to this show to be able to take a look at them and hopefully try it out.
Thank you.
So, Ileana, thank you so much. I really appreciate your being on the show with us today, and good luck with the conference. I'm sure it's going to be spectacular.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Shagara.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Salumi Artisan Cured Meats. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, my next guest is celebrated author, cook, and gardener Lucinda Hudson, and she's the author of the Herb Garden Cookbook and one of my very favorite books of all time called Tequila. Lucinda writes for many, many magazines, hosts PBS tours of her legendary house and gardens, and she also gives lectures around the country, and we're very fortunate to have her also as a columnist for Edible Austin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Marla. Nice to be with you.
Well, we're so happy that you can join us today. And we had Ileana de la Vega on just before you, and she was telling us about making moles and tamales and some of the celebratory foods that go with the Dia de los Muertos. And I would love for you to let us hear a little bit about how you turn, well, first of all, you turn every occasion into a party. That is your specialty. And so I would love to hear your thoughts on how would one go about giving a Day of the Dead party?
Well, as you know, it's one of my favorite celebrations of the entire year. And even though it can be kind of solemn because you're remembering your deceased loved ones, it's also a time to remember them with great festivity and to celebrate them with, you know, creating their favorite dishes again and remembering them and raising a glass to them and eating their favorite meals so you bring them close to your heart again. So what I like to do, it's usually in my garden because in Texas we have such nice weather, but I set up a beautiful altar and I bring out all my folk art and wonderful pieces that I've collected for Day of the Dead, from skeletons and, I have so many pieces that I bring out to do the altar with, and I understand that a lot of people don't have that, so you don't have to have all that to make a party. But I invite my friends and I ask them to bring something in remembrance of their deceased loved ones. So people show up with candles and flowers and photos and grandpa's cowboy hat and a deck of cards because your aunt loved cards. So we put all these things on the altar and it's really fun and festive, but we remember them. So the favorite food I like to do, I like to keep this simple because there might be a lot of people, and I love to do the champurrado, which is Mexican hot chocolate with cinnamon and almonds, and I put some marigold flowers, some Texas tarragon in it, and Mexican vanilla, and it's just delicious. And go to the bakeries to buy pan de muertos. Did you all talk about that?
We did. We talked a little bit about how the different breads are shaped like little icons.
Crossbones and corpses.
And, yes, and flavored with anise seed and
yes.
With orange. And
And, you know, the neat thing is that Day of the Dead is really crossing the border. So many people in the United States are really becoming interested in this celebration. So in your hometown, you can go to any of the Mexican markets, little stores, panaderias, and find this bread during this time. But if you can't find things like that, again, start celebrating your own family. Bring your grandma's favorite carrot cake and your tia's cookies and someone's spaghetti sauce or however you want to celebrate the party. It doesn't have to be Mexican.
And so what are some other dishes that are kind of more of the Mexican culinary
Well, pozole is real popular during that time, which is usually chicken, sometimes pork-based broth soup with hominy in it and chilies, and it has grated cabbage and onions over the top. Communal food, because the people are sitting at the graveyard, and they'll bring little cauldrons of these soups or platters of enchiladas, and the mariachis come through the graveyard, and people sing and drink mezcal, and where you're just really remembering your loved ones. So in our country, excuse me, as mentioned, people just may want to create a beloved dish of their deceased ones. You could have an Italian Day of the Dead party if you wanted.
That's really a great way to try to, I think this is a great celebration to spread among a lot of peoples, and it's such a great tradition to have.
Well, you know, it brings children and families, and we're so spread across the country in America that many of the young kids don't know their aunts and their uncles and cousins as much. And it's kind of a fun way to make children remember people that are, you know, that they've never heard of. And so in my parties, everybody will have a candle, and it'll be dark, whether inside or out, and we'll light a candle and have a prayer circle, which is another really sweet thing. And when I say prayer circle, I mean a moment of silence, that people just go around. You can go around the group, and somebody may honor somebody or say that person's name out loud, or somebody may choose that just as a moment of silence. But it's a remembrance circle, I should say. And that's always been very, very meaningful to people.
And candles are, you mentioned candles.
I've
seen candles used a lot on the altars and just in the rooms. And
well, you know, the party beforehand, people are festive and having fun, but this quiet circle is very, very touching to people. It's really amazing in this moment of silence what may come out for somebody. And think of so many people we've lost, not only in our families, but in the world, to remember people who have really touched our lives each year in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very, very special time to just pay homage and really, really respect people who have been important in your life.
And so many of our memories seem to be associated with food. I'm really struck by that, and that's one thing I love about this celebration, because the food is so integral to, and the drinking and the different memories that come associated with the food, that it makes it so special.
That is so true. I mean, in Mexico, many of the people are very poor, but they'll still have a wonderful little candy for their favorite. Oh, for the children, it's so hard because they make candies for that time of the year in shapes of little animals and real sweet little sugar things that the children would have loved for the deceased children.
Mm-hmm.
But people will put something on the altar that person loved. You know, abuelito's bottle of mezcal, whatever favorite foods are there. And it does. It just, food, I think, are some of our best childhood memories, aren't they?
They are. Could you give us just a real quick rundown? I think we can do this on the radio. The champurrado, there is a recipe for this in our current issue of Edible Austin and on
yes.
our website. But,
and will people be able to go there to find it, Marla?
They will.
Online? Good.
They will, but it's such an easy thing to make.
Yes, it really is. Well, in a medium saucepan, you're mixing together a little bit of masa harina, half a cup of masa harina, which is a corn flour, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And you mix that with water. That becomes the thickener. And then it's Mexican hot chocolate that you find in many stores at this time. And it's flavored with ground almonds and cinnamon and chocolate and sometimes anise. Then I'm going to add a little bit of 2 to 3 tablespoons of piloncillo, which is the Mexican unrefined brown sugar,
mm-hmm.
some Mexican vanilla, some 2 teaspoons of anise seeds, a half a teaspoon cinnamon, and I usually put a stick of cinnamon in there too, and a pinch of crushed dried red cayenne if you like, and a little bit of salt. And you just mix this up, and it becomes a very thick, almost pudding-like drink. And it's so wonderful to dip that Mexican pan dulce into. And everybody has a warm cup in their hands. And I just think that's a wonderful celebration. Sometimes I'll do a hot apple punch for the party. And occasionally I'll do soups, like black bean soup and pumpkin soup for the season, but that everybody has something warm in a cup instead of lavish tables of food.
Right. And that's a little bit easier, too, when you're making a lot of something to serve it that way.
Well, and because people really are, I think it's really important to keep the reason of this party, the remembrance circle, the people putting things on the altar and lighting candles, and, oh, people bring photographs of their loved ones and fun little memories of their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this party is about to me. So I kind of like to keep it drinks and pan de muerto or soup and kind of a simple party as far as the food, but very aromatic, flavorful food, too.
It sounds just wonderful. really looking forward to this coming up in the next couple of weeks. So, Lucinda, you just got back from a trip to Mexico, and
I did.
I think you're working on another edition of your wonderful book, Tequila
Book. Yes, I'm doing a rewrite. My book was way ahead of the times, and so I'm really excited to be doing a new edition of it, which really preserves a lot of the culture and heritage and traditions of tequila. Not only the drinks, but, you know, it's a folklore book as well.
Can you tell us just a couple of the highlights from your recent trip or some of the fun things you discovered or experienced?
Well, I went into so many of the small tequila-producing towns, and tequila there, it's so funny, the drinks there that are so beloved in Mexico with tequila are very simple. The margarita is more of an American theme, and the Mexicans will sip a shot of tequila or sip an after-dinner tequila. And believe it or not, the most popular drink in Mexico is just Squirt, which is the grapefruit soda, mm-hmm. Tequila, and a pinch of salt, because it's a light, easy drink that they can drink throughout a meal for the wonderful barbecues they have and the mariachis and, you know, so much food. It's just kind of a fun, light drink.
Well, and it also has a lot to do with the culture of a country. And so whenever you're introducing something like that to another country, again, one of the things I appreciate so much about the way you write is you really bring a sense of that culture and the authenticity of it to a people that may not know those things.
I think that's true. You know, when I look at so many tequila recipes now, they're just filled with all these other liqueurs, and it's almost like you're trying to mask the flavor of tequila, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite drinks down there is served in a big bowl, and it's just all the wonderful oranges, ruby red grapefruit, pineapple, oranges, lemons, limes, tequila, and the natural juices of all these fruits. And so the quintessential finger bowl, you know, you pick up the pieces of fruit and squeeze them into your mouth and then drink some of the punch. And it's just so natural and bright and easy and fun and communal. I think so much of the Mexican food and drinks is about family and sitting down, you know, together and having food in the middle of the table to pass around.
And the music.
And in this case, drinks. That's right. Yeah. Mariachis everywhere.
So did you get to hang out with the mariachis when you were down there?
I did. I got to sing with them.
Really?
That was, I think, the highlight. I don't know who scared who the most, but I got to get up and sing with the mariachis. So that was really fun.
I wish we had that on tape.
We have a picture of it. Maybe it'll be in my next book.
Oh, great. So, Lucinda, when do you expect this next version of the book to be out?
Oh, dear. It'll probably be at least a year. It hasn't gone to press yet. But it's going to be a special, I think, really preserving the traditions of Mexico. So wait for it.
We will. And we'll also remind our listeners before it comes out and have you back on the show at that time.
Oh, that'd be
one.
We'll really talk about tequila. People are very interested in it. And, of course, mezcal is becoming very popular as well.
What is the difference between mezcal and tequila?
Well, mezcal can be made from many different kinds of agaves, whereas tequila can only be made from the blue agave. Tequila would actually be considered a mezcal, meaning it comes from agave, but it only comes from the blue agave. From 5 states in Mexico, whereas mezcal can come from many different states. You used to think of mezcal as being more of the moonshine of Mexico, and now it's really becoming kind of the real nationalistic type drink that people are really wanting to preserve their culture by keeping mezcal alive. And mezcal is usually the agave, the heart of the agave, is cooked in an underground pit, and that's what gives it that smoky characteristic.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the best mezcal comes from, I would say, really from the Oaxaca area, whereas tequila comes from primarily the Jalisco and 5 states around there.
I see. So Can't wait to see and read all this, all about this in your new book.
Good. Thank you.
And one last question. Are you planning a day? This is a question from my husband, actually. are you planning a Day of the Dead party this year?
I don't know how I could not do that.
Oh,
it's
good.
Just, you know, the most, really, the thing I look forward to every year. For me, it's like Christmas, you know, taking down all the boxes of all the, the Day of the Dead skeletons and skulls and folk art and plates and platters and, you know, everything I've collected for years.
And it is life in the garden.
Yeah, and it's just remembering people I love and people that everybody else loves. It's a very, very touching party for people.
Well, Lucinda, thank you so much for sharing all of that with us today on the show.
Good, Marla. It was fun being with you.
Great.
And see you Day of the Dead, okay?
Okay, we'll see you.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Adios.
Adios, Lucinda. Okay, I'd like to thank our sponsor today, Salumi Artisan Cured Meats of Seattle, and tell you just a little bit about them. Salumi Artisan Cured Meats is a specialty meat curing factory and deli serving specialty Italian lunch items. Salumi cured meats are handmade, and then they're cured in a state-of-the-art curing rooms that are made specially to simulate the humidity, temperature, and airflow of a typical Italian basement, attic, or even a barn. Salumi is a family-owned and operated, and it's a retirement dream, actually, of the founders, Armandino and Marilyn Batali. Daughter Gina Batali and her husband, Brian D'Amato, are now the majority owners, and they operate both the deli and the curing factory. For more information on Salumi's unique, delicious products, visit salumicuredmeats.com. And we're going to take a short break right now, and then we'll be back with our next guest, Elizabeth Winslow.
Para nuestro representante, para su amigo, Luis Enrique Dame, Ficha Nueva, al señor Ernesto Moreno Bailón.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. And the show today is brought to you by Salumi Artisan Cured Meats. Thanks so much for joining us. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
I'm going to tell people just a little bit about you. You are, beyond being a committed locavore, you're a former chef, and you're a seasoned forager, You are recently formed a partnership to create a business called Farmhouse Delivery, and that's an all-local grocery delivery service. And I would like to start with just asking you to tell us a little bit about what inspired you to go into this farmhouse delivery business, and just a little bit about it.
Sure. I was working with a friend who has a small farm, and we were kind of working together to look at creating a CSA for her farm. It's a small urban farm in East Austin, but it's really actually quite small. She just farms about half an acre. So we realized that it wasn't going to be possible or sustainable to create a CSA with just produce from her farm. So we started looking at models of similar businesses and discovered that in England there is a business that they call a box scheme where a small farm buys produce from other farms and creates sort of a co-op. So that was sort of the seed for farmhouse delivery. And then we thought, well, hey, wouldn't it be great for people to also get delivery of grass-fed meats and farmstead cheeses and freshly baked breads? So now we offer all of that together, including some of the things from Rainlily Farm, my business partner's farm.
Okay, and that sounds wonderful. Are you getting a good response to this?
We are getting a good response. We have grown kind of steadily since we started last spring, and we've gotten through the lean months here in Central Texas of August and September, so starting to get some really pretty fall produce in, and that always gets people excited. And we're getting ready to start some new components to the business that we're really excited about, and that is components of the business that allow people to get really connected to the farm. So even though it is small and doesn't supply all of the produce in people's weekly deliveries, we still want them to be able to come out and see the farm and see how things grow. There's chickens there, and just kind of see the systems and get inspired for maybe some of their own urban farming projects and things that they could grow and do in their own yards to supplement their groceries that they buy from us.
Mm-hmm. And I know that one of the things that I think that's been pretty key to your success and that I've certainly enjoyed are some of these happy hours you've thrown out on the farm where you've invited people and invited chefs to come and cook. And speaking of things like this, you've got a really interesting one coming up, and I really wanted to get you to talk a little bit about what inspired you to do this Cuban pig roast that's coming up.
Yeah, we are really, really excited about this event. We, I actually wrote an article, as you know, last spring about I went and visited a local farm here, Richardson Farms, outside of Austin, where they are raising pigs and chickens and using rotational, sustainable methods, but really just kind of got very interested in the way that these pigs were being raised in a free-range environment and really, really happy. And I don't think that that's something that people often get to find out about, and so I really wanted to celebrate it. And my, as I wrote in the article, my mother has stories about growing up in Louisiana and in the fall harvesting a hog on her family's property every year. And lots of people, kind of a couple generations ago, really that was part of fall, was harvesting a hog, processing it, smoking the meat, and storing enough meat for the family to have for the coming year. So we just kind of started thinking what would be something really fun now that the weather is turning nice and it's fall, that would be sort of a celebration of fall. And so we wanted to do a pig roast. And we had a friend who built a really, really keen little contraption to do a Cuban pig roast. So that was sort of the inspiration for doing a Cuban pig roast. A Cuban pig roast is typically done around Christmas time, but we just kind of played with time a little bit and backed it up a couple of months. So,
well, now it's a new tradition to do it in the fall with the fall harvest and the.
Absolutely.
So, how are you going to prepare the pig?
Yeah, that's a really good question because this is going to be completely new for us. Our friend who built the roaster, it's called a cajachina. And it's basically a pit, I think, built out of cinder blocks, and then it's got a forged sort of cage. So the pig is going to be butterflied, the whole pig with the head on, butterflied, and then closed in this cage and roasted pretty slowly over charcoal and not wood. So it's going to take about 4 to 8 hours to roast. It's a pretty big one, 125-pound pig. And so we'll marinate it, probably starting on Thursday, in citrus and garlic and herbs. And I think one of the recipes that I've read recommends also some dark beer in there.
So that's always a good idea.
Yeah, beer never hurts anything. So we're going to marinate it in that and sort of a brine solution with some salt and some sugar and citrus juice and herbs for a couple of days, and then it will go on the grill on Saturday morning and roast all day.
And then what time will the celebration start?
It starts at 6 o'clock. People will come at 6, and we'll have a little appetizer, and we're really hoping that it'll be sort of a community celebration and very casual. It's going to be a seated dinner, but we want it to feel like a picnic, like a family gathering of people. So we're really excited. We've got a group of musicians coming, and they're called Las Gabachachas, and they're a group of women who are not Latinas, but they play Cuban music and are really interested in that style of music. And so they're going to be playing music, and people are going to, you know, bring bottles of wine and beer and just kind of be out there under the pecan trees and visiting and connecting.
On the farm itself, right?
Yep, yep. And the farm looks beautiful right now. The sunflowers are blooming, and everything is kind of coming into its own.
And will you have side dishes with the pig?
We will. We're going to have an appetizer, as I said, and I think we're going to do a Spanish-style tortilla with sweet potatoes and peppers and a little chimichurri sauce with that, and then a big salad, and then the Cuban black beans and a rice with cilantro, and then we've got a friend who's actually from Mexico who's going to be making a flan for dessert.
Oh, that just sounds wonderful. And so what I really love about what you're doing is that you're creating, not only kind of creating a new fall tradition out of some pieces of other traditions, but making it all local and making it all seasonal with what is growing around here right now. And I think that is such a great concept for beginning traditions and ensuring that they're going to go on and prosper and last forever.
Yeah, I agree, because traditions always begin from, you know, what you have available to you, and celebrating something that's authentic and real and here and now and of this place. So elements can come from other cultures, but it's really about where we are and who we are.
Right. So, Elizabeth, also I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about how you've made connections with the various farmers and producers in the area, not just for your business, but I know you've worked for other businesses where this was a critical piece of what you brought to the table, so to speak. And how do you make these connections with the farmers and ranchers, and you know, how do you find the people, and how do you make these connections?
Well, I think just really being interested in it and fascinated with it on an ongoing basis. So it's all out there, and there are a lot of really great resources to seeking people out. I always say start with the farmers market. If you go to the farmers market, you will meet, you know, one group of people, and through those people, you'll meet other people. When I first moved to Austin, I was reading The Omnivore's Dilemma, and the first thing I wanted to do was find somebody who was raising chickens. And so I called a local farmer, and he said, well, I'm not doing that anymore, but here's the name of my friend. Call him, and he's doing it. So I think that as kind of a group, they're really supportive of one another and always willing to kind of connect you with somebody else who's doing whatever it is that you're looking for. So the farmers market is always a really great place to just be able to walk around and visit with people and make those connections. And local harvest is a great resource. And just kind of being out, and if you see something that looks like somebody's growing something or doing something, just pull over. And, you know, I found that people are really always willing to share and open their doors and talk to you.
So if somebody wanted to do their own fall harvest pig roast, it's certainly possible. You don't have to own a local produce delivery service to be able to pull this together.
No. In fact, it would probably be better if you weren't trying to run a local produce delivery service while you're putting it together. So, you know, and the pig that we have is really big, but it's also really possible to call the farmer and let them know what size pig you wanted and about how many people you wanted to serve. So, you know, it's really possible to get one that's closer to 60 pounds, even, you know, 40 pounds. You can kind of specify what size, and the longer ahead that you would give them, the better. So if you're listening to this now and think, hey, that would be something really fun to do for Christmas, I would go ahead and start calling around now and kind of get your order in so you can get the size that you want.
You know, that's a really good point, and that's true of a lot of pastured meats products out there, that you really want to make your connection with the farmers well ahead of the time that you're going to be using it. People get so used to just walking into a grocery store and buying whatever they want the day before. But really with guineas and with chickens even, and certainly with turkeys and any of the heritage animals that we build some of our celebrations around, you really need to have that on order months ahead of time.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been taking reservations for Thanksgiving turkeys for a couple of months, and I just turned in some reservations this last weekend, and the Richardson said, you know, no more stop, we're running out of turkeys. You know, so
really?
It's the beginning of October, so definitely something worth seeking out as soon as possible. But they're, you know, they are don't have any really interest in having a bunch of stock in the freezer, so they really try to, you know, just raise what they can sell. So, and it's, you know, they're living creatures, so. It's, you know, it doesn't just get to 60 pounds and stay there forever. So they have to know when you want it.
And that helps the farmer or the producer also plan, you know, plan their crops or their production cycles around that as well.
Absolutely. And I really love the idea of, you know, creating a relationship with a farmer and buying half an animal. And, you know, that's kind of, people don't raise their own animals on the farm anymore, but if you buy half an animal or a whole one and have it processed to your specifications, you're basically doing the same thing.
And that's also a very economical way to procure your meats.
Very, very much more economical, and, you know, you're eating cuts of meat that you might not normally eat. You're not just eating boneless, skinless chicken breast 365 days a year. So I think it brings in some variety and some excitement to your cooking and gets you to try some new things and saves you money and creates a sustainable food system. So I think that's a great deal.
Well, that sounds great. So, Elizabeth, what do you have planning coming up ahead or planned for, like, the next big local feast you do or local event you do on the farm?
Well, the next thing, we were actually talking to Loncito Cartwright today, who raises lambs here in Austin, and he actually raises them in Dinero, but sells them here in Austin, and we were thinking how much fun it would be to do a whole lamb and kind of do a Greek theme with, you know, some wonderful Greek dishes. We're kind of past eggplant and moussaka, but I'm sure we can come up with some other things, but I just think it's a great way for people to really experience, to see how many people one pig can feed, or one lamb, or one goat. So I love that idea. I think that's something that people don't get to connect with very often, and I think it's just a great way to celebrate the life of the animal and to recognize that it does have a life, and, you know, it's a sacrifice and a really lovely thing to celebrate that it was raised humanely and happily and with respect.
And then is serving in a wonderful way after death.
Mm-hmm.
So to feed and live on.
Right.
Do you plan to use with the pig roast coming up this weekend? Are you planning to serve all of the hog, or do you have plans to do some other things with parts of the cooked?
I think that it should pretty much all, you know, we have some seats still available, but I think if we fill up, it's probably going to all be gone. But we also kind of thought about, you know, afterwards, if there is any left, maybe doing a happy hour with some pork quesadillas or some yummy way of using all the rest of it up.
I'm thinking of, like, the, you know, typically there's leftovers after a Thanksgiving feast, and so, you know, you can make soups, or you can make tacos, or you can make casseroles, or all kinds of different kinds of things that keep using something that you've made that's very large.
Yeah, and I use the freezer a lot for that. We had a big weekend a while back where we all smoked a bunch of lamb ribs, and we didn't eat them all, so I just put them in the freezer, and then you know, a week or so later, I put a big pot of beans on and just threw the lamb ribs in there, and it was amazing. It was, you know, it gives you, it's like a little flavor present. You know, when you have something like that left over that's taken hours and hours to cook, it's going to be very rich and intensely flavored and have a lot of depth to it, and so you can kind of throw it in with something easy, and it's really an amazing little, the gift that keeps on giving.
Right. It's the wonderful thing about cooking large and cooking for large groups, too.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to thank you so much, Elizabeth, for being on the show today, and I hope that this is inspirational to people to not only reach out to their local and sustainable farmers and ranchers, but just also to have a party and to celebrate our season and celebrate every season, but the fall season is especially exciting. And there are so many ways you can bring in different cultural elements and get your friends and families together and celebrate with food.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it, and I agree. It is great to, there's something really special about gathering together around a table outside, you know, in nature and getting to connect with people. That is, you know, an experience that we need to do more often.
And with the chickens, too. There'll be chickens
right,
there.
The chickens and the goats and the sunflowers.
There's a song in that somewhere.
There is.
So, well, thanks again, Elizabeth. I really appreciate your being on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is Marla Camp of Edible Austin and Edible Communities, and thank you for being with us today on Heritage Radio Network. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Salumi Artisan Cured Meats, for making this show possible. I'll be back on November 2nd, but tune in next Monday and every Monday for the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network. Have a happy Dia de los Muertos.